Hi, I'm Freddy Otto. I'm the acting director of the Environmental Change Institute here at the University of Oxford, and I'd like to welcome you to a special episode of Future Makers. You may remember me from previous episodes when we talked about the Paris Agreement and climate litigation, but this week we want to talk about COP25, which you may have been following. It has just concluded in Madrid. I thought I'd share some of my thoughts with you, but more importantly, those of my colleagues.
We've been doing this for 25 years every single year, and you know, some COPs have been more important than others. Hi, I'm Alex Clark. I'm a DPhil student in the School of Geography and the Environment. The science is not just settled now. It's extremely alarming how much action needs to be taken between now and 2030. You know, 7% year on year carbon reductions, carbon emission or greenhouse gas emission reductions globally, which is a huge mountain to climb. And the distance between the sort of political wrangling and the need for action is greater than ever.
And here is Professor Natalie Seddon from the Zoology Department.
We were really hoping that there would be a big hike in ambition for both climate mitigation and adaptation. And we were hoping that Article 6 would be adopted, and that the Article 6 that was adopted would have very robust social and environmental safeguards. What actually happened? Well, countries agreed to hold the line on ambition, and they did not adopt a version of Article 6 that would have been dangerous for, in terms of human rights and in terms of biodiversity and ecosystems in general. It is hard not to feel disappointed and frustrated, and feel angry that this gap between what's wanted and what's actually being delivered, or what's needed and what's actually being delivered, is growing and growing. So with each COP, this gap gets bigger and bigger. And, you know, something at some point has got to give. And I really hope that, you know, this year, next year, 2020 is the year where we narrow that gap in all these different ways. And we know how to do that. But obviously there are, you know, substantial political challenges. Even if we get agreement on Article 6 as it currently stands, the irony is that we still won't avoid dangerous warming. We will, in fact, undermine global climate ambition.
What, if anything, was decided at COP? In my view, it was decided to push the deck chairs around as if we were on the Titanic. Hi, I'm Helen Gavin from the Environmental Change Institute at the University of Oxford. It seems to have been another talking shop with little progress, pushing plans back for another year, which just means less action, fewer incentives to help everybody change their lifestyles, and more fossil fuels being used, and ultimately smaller steps taken towards a low-carbon world. I believe we, that is everybody who is concerned about climate change and wants to see positive action, we need to keep on the pressure, keep on doing things, unite with cities and businesses who want the same thing, and try and persuade those recalcitrant governments to make positive change.
I was at COP for the second week, very much a focus on climate migration. Hi, my name is Lisa Thalheimer. I'm at the Environmental Change Institute here in Oxford, where I'm a PhD student with Freddy Otto, and I also work with a group called Climate Econometrics over at Nuffield College. Summarizing COP25 in that regard, it was pretty much an intransparent disappointment. Climate migration is a very important issue, which unfortunately is not very much on the radar, or has not been on the radar of this COP. A lot has been framed around a doomsday scenario and kind of alluded to, both in negotiations as well as in other side events. When we talk about loss and damage, there's usually this narrative of climate refugees. However, we don't really have a quantitative framework. What are climate refugees? Is there any law perspective? No, but people kind of phrase it as a very much, as I mentioned, a doomsday scenario. And phrasing this topic as very negative was, I think, one of the disappointments.
COP25 was meant to be a relatively technical meeting, so no one was expecting a new Paris Agreement or something massive like that. But what it was about is a lot of the rules that underpin the Paris Agreement, and how do parties actually achieve what they pledged in their NDCs, and how do we achieve the Paris Agreement, basically. So one of the things that was happening that was supposed to have happened last year was finishing the rule book. It's still not quite finished. So that was one of the things that should have happened this year, where there is still some open text that will be pushed forward. And I think the most attention got Article 6, which is about how does it actually work to get ambitious emission reduction targets and then account for them, and how does it work between countries, which got a lot of attention, which was at a lot of very sticky points. And from my perspective, what was really important was that it was also due to review the Warsaw International Mechanism for Loss and Damage. So while in the Paris Agreement, loss and damage is in there in Article 8 as sort of an extra pillar between adaptation and mitigation, but the Warsaw mechanism on how what we do about loss and damage is not part of the Paris Agreement, and it was discussed at this COP, should it be part of the Paris Agreement, or should it just be something that is reported to the COP but not to Paris? And the short answer is it's still not part of the Paris Agreement, and I think that is really the worst message and the biggest disappointment, that actually no real progress at all has been made on loss and damage. And that is, the whole COP was a big slap in the face for the developing countries. I think that is the main outcome, and that is also the really worrying outcome.
Expectations were extraordinarily high. You know, since the last COP, we've seen this massive ramping up of activism in the climate space, including the Fridays for the Future movement and so on, and lots of, I think there was a great deal of expectation that this was going to be a COP of high ambition. And in many ways it was being, you know, viewed by people as being the trigger to a decade of ambition. Antonio Guterres, the Secretary General of the United Nations, said himself that there was an expectation for there to be a clear demonstration of ambition and commitment at COP25. He called for all world leaders showing great accountability and responsibility, and he actually went on to say that anything less would be a betrayal of our entire human family and all generations to come. Although no fresh pledges were expected, there was great hope for collective intent. And I think, you know, never before has there been such a sort of big disconnect before. So I think there was a real hope that progress would be made. And clearly, you know, that didn't happen.
One of the most worrying things really about this COP is this very arrogant and totally living in the past way of the developed countries to continue to behave in these negotiations, which was not only seen in the negotiations itself, but also in how some of the observers were treated.
It's very important for us to have a very strong multilateral process, and I think we have made great progress. Paris Agreement was a significantly important, very, very important step forward in terms of climate change and addressing climate change. I am always cautiously optimistic about what can be achieved, you know, within these 2-week timeframes, where you've got representatives of all the world's countries and you've got so many different interests there. And in a nutshell, really, at this meeting, you know, we saw both sides, yet again, you know, the high emitters on one side and the low emitters on the other side, developing countries on one side, developed nations on the other side, you know, both holding fast onto their views.
There are very good reasons why these issues are still unresolved. And as you have no doubt heard from the news, you know, China, the US, Brazil and India have been consistently identified as those obstructing negotiations over these particular issues. But, you know, it's raising a whole lot of interesting questions, at least for kind of researchers, over multilateralism and what future it's got, particularly looking forward to next year in Scotland.
It is tempting to point fingers at different countries and accuse different countries of slowing the process or deliberately trying to disrupt the process. But there are, you know, very, very serious technical issues and political issues that need to be ironed out. And you know, it does obviously always feel like the most vulnerable communities will suffer the most under the terms of whatever text gets agreed. And we have to work hard to build capacities to support those countries to make sure that their rights are respected in these negotiations. And that is definitely a thing. But equally, it's really complicated because you have these overall global goals, but you have them implemented through these national policies, these nationally determined contributions. Now, these documents are generated by the country. They're supposed to be meaningful, they're specific to the particular socio-political and ecological context of that country. And that varies country by country. And this presents very substantial technical challenges of how you promote cooperation between those countries, how you transfer, this whole offsetting stories. But it becomes very complicated, doesn't it? If different countries are using different rules, have got different targets, different time frames, it becomes technically extremely difficult. So some of those countries that are are being accused of disrupting the process also arguably have some fairly, solid grounds for pointing out these technical difficulties and saying, these need to be improved. Having said that, there are some major red lines. I think Costa Rica is leading a progressive group of nations on a set of guiding principles called the San Jose Principles, which are all around the red lines around Article 6, which promote the safeguards for society, environment, which get around issues around double counting and so on. And if we adopt those principles, then we are likely to have a much more ethical, much more balanced system. But they will be opposed by the big emitters. And the silence of the big emitters obviously speaks volumes at these meetings, and it's the same at every meeting, and that's what needs to change.
So I think one of the most inspiring and best things about the COP was that when Greta Thunberg and Luisa Neubauer, who is the Fridays for Futures leader in Germany, when they did a press conference and they didn't speak at all, but they gave the stage to people from developing countries and let them tell their stories. And I think that is one of the most important things that needs to happen, that we change who is talking, who is speaking, who is acting. Because the Paris Agreement is about making our future not horrible. And for a lot of the people in developing countries, the present is already quite bad. And of course, the future is most important for young people. And so as long as these negotiations are, sorry if I say that, but are really just discussed by old people from developed countries, old white people, we will not achieve what we need to achieve. So I think that they so impressively just did not say a word at all, these two, who are from, of course, highly developed countries, but said, no, you need to listen to this, these people. That was great. What was then the really bad reaction of that was then, I think the next day, that a lot of the observers and the young people were not admitted into the COP and had to stay outside for a day. And that was just such a bad signal. Very honest that no one cares about these people, but that was really worrying from my point of view.
On the one hand, the kind of the future of multilateral negotiations is very much unclear. It's just not clear, particularly given the political trends on the national level in key countries, particularly those moving towards the right, whether these things are going to be able to be resolved. But one of the bright spots in the outcome document of the Madrid negotiations was over the continuation of the non-state actor role within the UNFCCC. And frankly, without that, at this point, the whole point of the process would really be, it would be possible to very seriously question what the whole point of this thing is without being able to bring in other aspects of society, meaning business, including the private sector, and civil society.
We have to get better at finding ways to build coalitions. And I think that civil society and the business sectors have to step up. I do think that we need policy interventions, obviously. And I think we need to really galvanize the business community, because if we want to have a world that we are proud for our children to be living in and inheriting in what are going to be rapidly, rapidly decreasing timescales, then we got to get our roller skates on and get going fast.
Hi, I'm Charmian Love. I am an entrepreneur in residence at the Said Business School at the University of Oxford. I'm also the chair and co-founder of B-Lab UK, and I have the great privilege of co-chairing B-Lab's Global Climate Task Force. I think collective action, working together, is what's going to help us find the speed and urgency under our feet that we need in order to make sure that when we're looking at 2030 and 2050, we're doing whatever we can. I think there are going to be moments where we will need to be clear
how to be on the right side of history. And we will feel those moments more profoundly over the next few years, I think, than maybe some of us are prepared for. Change isn't just coming, change is happening, and that there is a chance for us today, in every moment, in every decision we're making, to be on the right side of history. And I think more and more people are realizing that, and I think more and more businesses are realizing that people are realizing that, and I think we're going to start seeing an increasingly virtuous cycle of action coming from businesses because they are listening, they are tuning in, and they know that this is going to be important for them to be able to survive and thrive in the 21st century and beyond.
So our goal is not to overthrow capitalism, but we do think that it needs a tune-up. Hello, I'm Bill Clark. I'm a lawyer from the United States. I have spent my professional career practicing corporate and business law, and I now am deeply involved in thinking about how to improve capitalism and make it function and work better for all of us as we think about the problems we face as a society globally. I'm here at Oxford talking to a number of the faculty at the business school that are working on these exact problems. It would be great if we saw government action, but I think we should assume that we will not, or it will be difficult at least. But at the same time, I think we need to be hopeful that business can, through the market, adjust the way that it does business, enter into new industries. There's nothing that says you need the government in order to have businesses more invested in alternative energy sources, in electric vehicles, in many things that will change the problems that we're creating for the planet. And a lot of us believe that if businesses adopt those kinds of practices, they will actually be more successful. They will attract more consumers, and they will find that they benefit from this more responsible approach.
What's next for COP26 in Scotland? So I think what we've seen this year is that there are plenty of well-meaning diplomats in key countries, particularly Brazil and the US, who are very well-meaning, but their hands are basically tied. And the wrangling is still over issues of equity and finance. The next sort of 12 months might bring some pretty important developments in not just in finance and sort of central bank governance and stuff like that, but also in business really starting to call for regulation, appropriate regulation from governments in a much more vocal way. So we'll see how that goes.
Because of what happened at COP25 or what didn't happen at COP25, it means we've got a lot to do. We need biodiverse ecosystems in order to store and sequester and store carbon over the long term. So we need to really improve the wording around that and make sure that those environmental safeguards are there. There's a lot of work to be done. And, you know, it would be really, really good to see Article 6 improved to include the social safeguards, improved to avoid double counting, improved so that the needs of the most vulnerable people across the world are met and are not overlooked in Article 6. But this is going to take a lot of work over the next 12 months, and it means that there's even more to achieve at COP26.
Well, if it would all depend on the negotiation and the nation states, then you cannot be optimistic, or you cannot be very optimistic, I think. But I think what is really important is that no matter what the nation states are doing, we will not achieve the Paris Agreement goals without the non-state actors anyway. I think a lot of these non-state actors completely understand that and actually want to do something about it. So we have talked in one of the earlier episodes about the importance of cities, and that in even if, for example, in the US, where the state itself is not exactly a leader in terms of climate change, but some of the cities are really doing very ambitious things. So that's one group of non-state actors. But then there are also big companies. And we have also talked not me personally, but in other episodes, we have talked about capitalism and in a capitalistic system that our system is, big companies are very powerful. And so one of the things that also happened during the COP is that, for example, Goldman Sachs said that they are going to divest from fossil fuels. And I think it's these kind of things that make me hopeful that actually those companies are really interested in the fact that they will still be able to make a profit in the future. And climate change, if it's going to become really bad, will make that less possible. And so they have a huge interest in actually achieving climate goals. And so I think that that does make me hopeful. And also the fact that our kids are actually really forcing us and fighting very loudly and increasingly so, that we as the older generation have to listen, that is a lot of reason for hope. And I think in terms of the COP themselves, a lot of things have been left unfinished here at the COP. And while that seems a very bad thing, I think it's also quite good actually for some cases that they have been pushed forward, because a bad deal would have been much worse than no deal. And so there are things like to do with Article 6, for example, that will be now negotiated next year. And I think especially we as Oxford and as the UK have a huge opportunity to try and help and make COP26 a real success. A lot depends on it, so there's a lot of pressure, but there are also a lot of opportunities. That was our special episode of Future Makers. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it.